This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. All this week on the program, we've been focusing on various aspects of mental health care in Vermont. Our list is by no means exhaustive, but we're trying to get a sense of some of the big issues in the healthcare system, public policy, policing, and regular people's lives. Today, we're going to spend the hour talking about what it's like to be a family member, support person, or caregiver for someone who struggles with a mental illness. It can be very difficult, isolating, and scary for some. And we're going to talk about some of the ways caregivers can find support for themselves. I'm joined today by three people with personal experience in this arena, and they're all part of a group called NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. It's designed to be a network for people caring for loved ones with mental illness, as well as for people who have mental illnesses. Lori Emerson is Executive Director of NAMI Vermont. Lori, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Jim Johnson is a Family Support Facilitator for NAMI Vermont. Nice to have you with us, Jim.
Thank you, Jane.
And Sarah Moran is a board member of NAMI Vermont and a former teacher of NAMI's Family to Family class. Sarah, welcome to the program to you.
Thank you, Jane.
Before we get into the way NAMI works and some of the support systems that are out there, Jim, I'm hoping that you could help by putting some firsthand experience to what we're talking about today, what it is actually like to be a caregiver, a family member, to love someone who struggles with a mental illness, and what that's been like in your life.
Big question. My family has been dealing with mental illness for approximately 30 years. My summary statements at the present would be a collection of 30 years' experience. We've learned that we have a huge need for the acceptance of a new reality. There's a new norm. Not until probably 7 years ago did we put the word grief on our feelings.
This is you and your other family members who are looking at this as grief?
Right. And the reason for that is because in some respects, our son, who has to deal with bipolar and OCD through no fault of his own, changed. And so there's a before and an after. And in the support group, there's a tendency for many parents. The support group we have is made up primarily of parents whose loved ones are their children. And there's a huge desire to get back to the before. And sometimes that isn't possible, at least at the present time. So what happens for a newbie, a family will come into the support group, and they are blindsided. They find that they have a stranger in their home, which would be very, you know, difficult to begin with, and that there's an adjustment as to how to deal with a stranger. And the stress levels, of course, are all over the place, mostly because they're not aware of what's really going on, and they feel like their situation is unique. The beauty of the support group and the beauty of NAMI, which is very, very concerned about putting educated, a NAMI-educated personnel in positions of teacher, that NAMI has produced, in my opinion, a really beautiful situation for people who are dealing with mental illness for the first time. And so there's a huge need for people to get back in balance. And one of the ways of doing that is that the support group, when they say something that they feel is totally off the wall and never heard of before, most of the heads around the table start nodding.
Like what? What might somebody say that they would think, gosh, nobody feels the way I do?
Admitting that there's no logic to their child's behavior. And that in my particular support group, I almost preach that there is no logic. And sometimes if you look around our news today, there isn't much there either. But in any event, the idea of feeling alone and feeling that they're in a leaky boat bailing as hard as they can is very disconcerting. So when they get into the group, they find that everyone else is bailing too. And they feel part of a situation that there's hope for.
Well, listeners, let me invite you into the conversation at this point as well, because, you know, Jim is talking about perhaps more people getting into what feels like a sinking boat can actually help make that boat feel like it's floating a little bit more or find some stability. And I know that there are others out there who are dealing with this, and maybe you have some questions or an experience that you would like to share. And we would love to hear what the biggest challenges are for you as a caregiver or someone who loves somebody who's struggling with a mental illness, how you try to prioritize self-care, and where you found support. Jim, you said some people feel like suddenly there's a stranger in their house when an illness first presents itself. Is that what it felt like to you?
Yes. It was about a 180-degree role reversal on the part of our son. And we didn't have NAMI at the time. We didn't have NAMI for almost 15 years. So we were on our own pretty much. And he didn't want to do a whole lot, so we said, well, we'll let him watch TV all the time. Well, that didn't work. Then we wanted him out of the house for a certain time of the day, and that didn't work. It was a real lot of trial and error.
And your son is an adult now?
Yes. And so in the progress of all this, from a family perspective, we found that marriages are in distress. And when I talk to individuals outside of the support group, I suggest that they might want to shore up their relationship, and if there are any cracks, to amend them, because the stress of two different individuals looking at the same problem presents a lot of challenges. And generally speaking, I found that men want to fix it, and when they can't fix it, they don't know what to do. And the women have a mother's heart, which is needed also. So when you have those two going on and the loved one is not cooperating, then there's all sorts of room of stress. And so this is a big, big area for many of the people. And then there's also just the concerns of, well, it used to be, I haven't heard it, I don't know who said it, but so supposedly in the 80s, the doctors would basically blame the mother for the mental illness of the child, which is horrendous. And so one of our sayings is that we forgive ourselves and reject guilt, because we are human, we will make mistakes, and we're doing the best we can. So this becomes huge for a family situation, and it goes into the siblings. Siblings don't know what to do with it. They're not, well, I don't know. I'm not sure if maturity comes into the picture here too much. But siblings have become, in some cases, a real situation where they don't either accept or they reject the situation. And
you know, Jim, you're giving us a lot of really sort of an amazing overview of all the different ways and different people who are affected by one person's illness. And I see Lori and Sarah, you're nodding along to some of what Jim is saying, because both of you have had personal experiences dealing with and loving somebody in your family who has a mental illness. But you're also involved in this organization that Jim's talking about, NAMI Vermont, that serves as this support network for people. And Lori Emerson, you're the executive director of NAMI Vermont. Maybe you could explain a little bit about how NAMI does help support people who are trying to address these challenges.
Sure. We have a lot of programs to be able to help educate families. And one of our programs is the Family to Family class. And it's a 12-week program. Really helps people understand problem solving, giving them coping mechanisms, how to communicate with their loved one. And it really helps them to empower them to know what to do if a crisis arises. And it has been very supportive, as well as we have a one-day program. And that's for the entire community. Anybody can take the mental illness and recovery workshop. We also provide education for professionals who may want to take our, it's called our provider education class. It's a 15-hour class. There's a lot of different educational opportunities that really help empower people and gives them a better understanding what is mental illness and normalizes what mental illness is. All of our programs are free. We do get funding from grants. We also get donations and contributions. And our programs are also developed by the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So we do have one Vermont-based program. And they're signature programs, they're evidence-based, and it gives people a really great opportunity to network with other people who are going through the same experiences. That really creates a network for them to be able to help understand what other families go through, share different resources, and you really feel like you're not alone. And I think, you know, what, you know, one of our values as NAMI Vermont is that we practice non-judgmental, unbiased acceptance. And that's what NAMI has to offer. We also have support groups for individuals with mental health challenges as well as family members. So there's plenty of opportunities to get involved. And people usually come to us when they're in crisis. And it takes quite a while before they get to a point of advocacy where they can give back. But I would say family members and caregivers really experience the same trauma that their loved one feels because you're involved with their lives and you really see what they experience and you really feel for them. And it is very traumatic to go through a crisis with people.
Sarah, beyond sort of witnessing what your loved one is going through, what are some of the pressures or some of the additional burdens that a family member might feel? And I hesitate to use the word burden because I'm not trying to assess blame or make somebody who is experiencing mental illness feel guilt about family members. But because we're talking about the experience of what it's like to be caring for someone and knowing that there are issues of isolation and depression that family members can feel, could you illuminate some of those additional pressures that a caregiver might feel?
Well, I think that Jim identified several of them, and I think that it's just very stressful when someone that you love is in crisis, and you try to figure out what you can do. What are the resources that are available to help you? And if it's a child, if it's your child, as Jim mentioned, you have two parents who are coming at it from different perspectives, and going through the process of trying to understand it at different different ways. And so you're trying to coordinate all of that. You're trying to figure out what's out there. You're trying to figure out even what's happening. And I think another thing that Jim hit on was you're dealing with someone that you love that you used to be able to communicate with, and suddenly there's no logic. There's no way of working with that person having them be logical, and it's very frustrating. And then you have fears, like if it's your child, well, are they going to be able to finish school? Are they going to be able to take care of themselves in the long run? What's their future going to be? What do I need to do to help them get there?
So these sort of or parental concerns, but really elevated because of an illness that your child is feeling.
And I can imagine as a parent, you do have some control over your children. But if you're if it's your spouse or your parent, it puts you in a totally different situation in having to problem solve.
The class that you led, you're a former teacher of this family-to-family class that Lori was talking about. What's the value of having that peer-to-peer network, having other families to talk to, and having somebody who's leading the class who also has experience as a family member?
Well, first of all, I like to consider myself that I was a facilitator and not a teacher, because just as you say, I'm a person that was dealing with it myself. So I think there's a lot of empathy there, understanding what the person is going through. One of my experiences when, as I live my life, when people find out that I've been involved with family to family, people who've had issues just talk to me. I'm safe. I'm someone who they don't have to explain.
We are talking today about what it's like to live with or care for or be closely tied to someone who's struggling with a mental illness. When we come back, we're going to get some advice for some of our listeners who have sent in questions that they have about their own experiences and hear more from our guests, Lori, Jim, and Sarah. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Tripod. Have you heard of it? It's about trying podcasts. This month, we want you to tell a friend about a podcast you think they'll really love. If they don't know how to listen or to subscribe, you can walk them through the steps. The Tripod hashtag has a ton of great recommendations if you are looking for inspiration. And be sure to share yours, too. That's Tripod, T-R-Y-Pod. Happy listening. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're exploring the issues faced by people who care for and are intimately connected to people who have mental illnesses. It's part of our week-long look at issues in mental health care in Vermont. If you have a story you'd like to share or a question to ask, maybe you're looking for some advice, or you'd just like other people to know what your life is like, you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. You can email vermontedition@vpr.net. And we're talking today with three people who are involved in NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Lori Emerson leads the Vermont chapter. Jim Johnson is a family support group facilitator. And Sarah Moran used to teach NAMI's family-to-family class. All three of them have dealt with these issues in their own lives as well. And let's go to Melissa, who's calling in from Essex. Hi, Melissa. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I just felt the need to call because I got in my car driving to pick up my child from school, and I heard the folks from NAMI speaking, and I'm so grateful that this topic is on the radio this week. And I have raised my child pretty much by myself for the last 14 years, and she's very complicated, very gifted, very special. She developed auditory and visual psychoses about a year ago, and it's just been torture. And the description that the gentleman gave of being in a sinking boat and just bailing as fast as you can was so apt. And the compassion I heard in the lady's voice, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name because I was driving, but the compassion and the really clear understanding of what families are going through is just so greatly appreciated.
Melissa, how are you managing, and how are you managing to care for yourself in addition to your child?
Well, I'm actually even having a hard time talking about it because it's been such a traumatic time, and we tried a short inpatient psychiatric stay earlier this week, and it didn't work. She couldn't tolerate it, and I just wanted to tell families that it's really important to realize that not one solution fits all children, all teenagers. And because at first we were feeling like, oh, no, we've let everybody down because this inpatient stay that was supposed to be so great and everybody was encouraging, just it wasn't right for my child. And I just went home that night thinking there's just another way. And I've reached out to places like Northeastern Family Institute, and we've been involved with the DAP program, which is Diagnostic Assessment Program, and the Howard Center. And I just encourage families to just ask for help and to realize that there are resources available.
Melissa, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your story. And I hope you realize there is a lot of compassion for you in this room today. And I'm sure people hearing your story as well. Lori, what about, I mean, Melissa's talking about, first of all, there is no one-size-fits-all solution, and you do have to become an advocate. But, boy, that's awfully hard when you're trying to go through this.
It is. And, you know, there isn't just one treatment that's going to work for everybody. You do have to figure out what's going to work best for that particular individual. And it can look very different for everybody. And I think it's really trying to figure out what that is and encouraging your loved one to keep doing that treatment that works for them. And sometimes that's the hardest part, is encouraging them to get treatment, number one, and then to have them follow through, because they're really in charge of their own recovery.
Even when they're a child?
A parent has more influence in being able to help that process. You know, once you're 18, it gets a lot more difficult. And I think the only influence you really have is by supporting them and encouraging them.
We got an email about that, and then, Sarah, I'll come back to you as well. But a listener wrote in to say, I am very regrettably had to divorce my smart, talented husband of 46 years. He convinced a psychiatrist to reduce his medication, which started a huge ongoing cycle of mania and hypomania. After 9 years of relative wellness while he was on medication, at present, my former husband has no insight into his illness. Do your guests have any suggestions for me and my adult children to perhaps convince my former husband to voluntarily seek medical help? He's now so estranged from us all. He thinks that we are the problem, and mostly me, his former wife, and one who still cares, however, so very much. So, Sarah, again, to what Lori was talking about, you know, the difficulties in trying to get someone who's suffering to access treatment. And I know you wanted to jump in there on what she was saying.
Well, she used the word insight, and that's exactly such a significant issue, as people, as they're experiencing their illness, they don't have that insight. And that's one of the things that causes so much frustration, because you can't be logical with them. I think it's a very difficult situation. So you need to shore up your supports and recognize, what is it, St. Francis prayer? Recognize what you can do and what you can't do.
Jim, to that note, you know, what advice do you have for people, or you know, maybe we can explore this idea of when you do have someone you care about, but you also have to protect your own life, your own heart, your own, sometimes your own financial resources, to make sure that you are protecting yourself. And that can be so difficult, especially if you're a caregiver, but also trying to sort of protect yourself. Do you have advice for people on how to do that?
One of the principles of support that we mention at the beginning of each support group meeting is that we accept we cannot solve all problems. And this is important, because the idea of being human, which has already been mentioned, and not being able to do everything you want to do, has to be accepted. The other thing that we have found in the support group is that the bottom line and the reason why most of the loved ones keep coming back is they know that their parents love them. And I think in the email that you read, I think the husband probably recognizes that his family does love him, and he is so torn up with himself that he doesn't show probably that he does, that they do love him. But we found many cases where the patient will have an explosion of verbiage, and when it's all over with, they'll come back and apologize or say that they really didn't mean it. So the big thing that makes I always wanted, when I was talking to my son, to take the mental illness and parallel it with the physical. You know, well, I take my pills, you need to take your pills. And most of those turn out to be pretty lame. And the loved one is usually quite astute as to the reality of what you're saying. But it is important to it's excruciatingly important that the caregiver tries to get into the person's head as to what's going on with them and why they react the way they do. And that can be done. The support group gets tired of me saying this, but I've got a whole new audience. I really honestly believe that in many, many cases, the patient in a mental illness situation is mad. And why is he mad or is she mad? Well, they have a terrible situation that they have to deal with, in most cases not through their own mistakes or anything, and it's frustrating. The frustration, in my opinion, comes from being marginalized, and they are marginalized with all the things our society doesn't want to deal with. Poverty, illiteracy, homelessness, all these things. And who would want to be put in that group? So some of the anger, of course, is transferred to the family. And dealing with the anger is a huge victory when the parents or the family members can shut down the anger and shut down the escalation. Because this happens almost all too frequently.
You know, we actually got a comment that sort of illustrates what you're talking about here from a listener who says, as someone who is bipolar, I have been involuntarily hospitalized and many times felt the hands of others intervening in my mental health. The most difficult aspect of maintaining relationships with my family and friends has been reestablishing trust that I can take care of myself and lead an independent life. I have been infantilized by my parents, and it's been difficult to feel as though I can be honest, and even myself, with those I have felt closest with. I find the most solace in my mentally ill peers who have dealt with this issue, but feel that my relationship with my parents in particular will never be the same, and can never be the same, out of my own fear that they will strip away my ability to live as a normal adult. We're getting a lot of comments from listeners who are sharing their experiences, their stories, and thoughts and questions. Lisa says, one tiny thing I regret almost daily is hearing the casual use of schizophrenic to mean other traits. I hear it used even to say holding two views or changing one's mind often. I know this hurts me as the sister of someone facing the challenges of mental illness. And we got another note from a listener who says, I am a mom really struggling to hold everything together while my partner's mental illness seems to be getting worse and worse. I am trying to get him help, which is scary and hard for him, but also trying to keep life going for our two kids, my job, his business, etc. Listeners, you can share your thoughts with us or your questions or your advice for others on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Today, we're exploring some of the ways families, caregivers, partners, and friends face challenges and sometimes suffer greatly as they live with or love a person dealing with mental illness. We are not trading in guilt here. We're talking about the isolation, though, that sometimes people feel, the heartbreak, how people can find support. And we're talking with three people who are involved in NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Lori Emerson leads the Vermont chapter. Jim Johnson is a family support group facilitator. And Sarah Moran used to teach NAMI's family-to-family class. All three of them have dealt with these issues in their own lives as well. And we're hearing from some of you. And let's go to another caller who's calling in but would prefer to remain anonymous. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. So I'm calling as a parent who has a child, early 20s, that suffered from pretty severe depression for several years now. And just as a father, the feeling of hopelessness that I feel in trying to help. And myself, I've had bipolar since I was a late teen, and I'm in my mid-50s now. And even with that lifetime experience, there's still this inability to really know what to do sometimes. You can give advice and listen, but it's always the other person who's got to deal with it, and it's really out of your hands most of the time. And another thing, what my illness did to my family, my children, and ex-wife, it's just like throwing a grenade into a calm pond at first, and there's just shock and disbelief in what's happening, and then later on, just the grief of, you know, losing part of that person. And I think there's a real, the tragedy is that most family members don't know how to respond, and they just want to fix it. My parents, it was just like, well, you just need to get a job, or you just need to go to counseling or take medications. And sometimes one of those things might work, but sometimes none of them work. And there's a real lack of insight into how someone with bipolar, the roller coaster ride they go on, and, you know, wanting to go off medication sometimes because the medication oftentimes that they prescribe, the side effects can be real detrimental. And also there's just a disbelief why you'd want to get into a manic state after what, you know, family went through the last period, but it's the only time that there's relief from that that blackness that surrounds your life all the time. And the only one who can understand that is the person who's, you know, feeling that constant depression.
Well, and I really appreciate you sharing your story and describing what it's been like for you, but also now for parenting someone who's going through some struggles. And Sarah, you wanted to jump in here.
Well, I really appreciated that gentleman sharing that insight of his situation and having gone through it himself and being a parent. And that's where the family-to-family program really can be helpful. Some family members have even taken the course more than once because they go through the symptoms and the issues that families and loved ones have to deal with. And when you come through, when you go through the process of how to cope with a family member with mental illness, and you learn how to do some self-care activities, and you learn that, you know, there are programs, that there are opportunities to move forward, you do end the program on a hopeful note. So I would encourage that gentleman to consider signing up for the family-to-family program.
Let me see if we can fit another call in here from someone calling in from Brattleboro. Hello, listener, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, we're happy to have you here.
Thanks. So I'm calling because I identify as a psychiatric survivor, and that means I've been in the mental health system quite a bit and largely found it to be harmful to me rather than helpful. And my experience with NAMI, having been a former member and having many friends who are part of NAMI, is that their perspective seems to be largely that people's emotional and social distress, the kind of struggles that arise from trauma and poverty and other sorts of oppression, are brain diseases. And the explanation for that emotional suffering is a biochemical one. And for many of us, that's not the way that we actually understand our struggle. We don't see our brains as broken. We see the world around us as broken, actually, and we're responding to that. And so I'm curious to hear from folks whether there's a shift going on in the world, certainly, towards a new and different and more accepting understanding of people's responses to distress. And I'm curious if that shift is happening within NAMI as well, or
Lori, because I hear what you're saying, and I want to make sure we have time to answer it, and we're short on time, and I appreciate you calling in. So Lori Emerson is Executive Director of NAMI Vermont. What do you think?
Yes, everybody's experiences are different. And what might happen with one person is very different than the next. And it's not all the same. And we do understand that, you know, people do also look for different treatments that might help them. So everybody is unique. And, you know, we do understand the complexities and uniqueness that everybody does have.
Lori, I know one of the things that's important to you is to say that it's not all crisis and it's not all doom and gloom.
No, it is not. One thing that I really want to mention here is that there is hope. There is recovery. And people who do keep working on their treatment, whatever that might be, people get to a place where they feel that now I can give back. Now I'm in an advocacy phase, and people reclaim their lives. And it, you know, they do have to manage, their health throughout their lifetime. And you know, what we have to offer are those opportunities to give back.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that perspective as well as we close out this conversation, one of many, about what it's like to be a family member and a loved one of somebody who's struggling with a mental illness. Lori Emerson is Executive Director of NAMI Vermont. Jim Johnson is a family support group facilitator. And Sarah Moran is a board member of NAMI Vermont and a former facilitator of NAMI's Family to Family class. Thanks to all three of you for sharing your perspective today. And our series continues and concludes tomorrow when we look at what ideas the legislature is considering to address problems in the system. This includes reducing turnover at designated agencies by increasing the base pay for staff and offering reduced tuition to attract more students into the psychiatric and substance abuse treatment fields. Send your questions or perspectives to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and be sure to tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening. Thank you.